The first scene in the movie, and I think it's in the book, I can't remember, it's called Lost and Stuff, that shows the main character at the Louvre in Paris, the famous house, the final resting place of Mary Magdalene. I can imagine in years to come that this will be something, because it's the closing vision of the film, it's going to be something that people would look to debate, so all of Mary Magdalene's very clear. So in your search, have you got any evidence to suggest that that definitely is the way she would go? So
that
I can dream
for
the future.
So, in a sort of reverse delegation, because this is an unanswerable question. I have no idea where she's going.
I have no idea where she's buried. The legend that she ever went to France is an unhistorical legend. It dates back to medieval periods where churches were falling over themselves to try and have relics of saints, because it was the time of great pilgrimages. And if you had some impressive relics, if you had James's fingernail or Thomas's toe clippings or something, then, you know, pilgrims will come beating a path to your door. So the evidence is that this particular church, I can't remember where in the south of France, invented the story that they had the bones of Mary Magdalene because they were on the great pilgrimage route down to Santiago. But there's no evidence that she ever was there. If you want to find out more about that, Susan Haskins, her book Mary Magdalene, Myth and Metaphor, will tell you everything you ever dreamed of wanting to know about Mary Magdalene and more besides.
Hi, I've just recently been on the list of the Christian religion, and this is like really friendly, this big case. On Frank Corday Monday, there's a program on Channel 5 that I just started watching, had to go out, and they actually found like a chateau in Normandy with a statue of Mary Magdalene, and I can't understand why she's there and not Mary, Mother of Jesus, you know.
It must be another difficult question. Well, the whole Mary Magdalene thing that I think we have to really get hold of is that there's a little bit about her in the Bible, in the New Testament. It really doesn't say very much. She and some other women went around with Jesus and his crew, helping to support them when they were travelling around. She was there when he was crucified, and she was the first person to see him after he rose from the dead. And that's it. That's really all that we get about her from the kind of real history, if you like, back then. And then in the Middle Ages, there's all this stuff that grows up. And what we need to understand is that the Middle Ages was a huge age of ignorance. Right? There was a time of the Greek and Roman culture where people wrote things down and were well educated and knew lots of stuff. And then there's today. And there's a period in the middle that's ignorant and superstitious. And all kinds of fantasies and wishful thinking and exploitation grew up during that time. And you get all this stuff about Mary Magdalene going to France and Rennes the Chateau and the Cathars and all that blip that comes later. But there's a complete historical divide between that and what we know about the real Mary. And as Tony was saying just now, in the Middle Ages, churches and locations got into this industry of having sort of spiritual souvenirs. And the Turing Shroud, but the Turing Shroud is an ideal example. Let's not go there. Sorry, I shouldn't have started that one. But there's a whole medieval industry about saints and souvenirs. And it doesn't really add anything to what we know historically.
Yeah, but if you go into a church, you've always got the cross, you know, with Jesus on it, and everything. And, and then also, you've always had Mary, you know, alongside, so I was actually in South Catholic, not a good religion, but each their own. But they just all of a sudden, Mary's been pushed aside, and now it's like everything's on Mary Magdalene. And I couldn't grasp it when the statue was there of Mary Magdalene and not Mary, you know.
You'll find churches with other statues at the front as well. All the other apostles, Paul and the apostles in Jesus' team, They've all been put centre stage by some church or other in various places. I don't think it means anything particularly. But if you're trying to construct a conspiracy theory, if you're trying to, maybe I shouldn't call it a conspiracy theory, but it is one. If you're kind of trying to construct this theory of Mary Magdalene at the centre of everything, then, of course, this tiny little out of the way church that's got a statue where it shouldn't have becomes very useful evidence. But if that theory is fundamentally flawed, then it's just a little church that has put a statue in an old place. And we could construct other theories that required different apostles to be centre stage, and we could find evidence that fit. But whether little bits and pieces of unconnected evidence actually add up to a coherent whole, that's the problem. It doesn't add up. And Dan Brown's skill as a novelist, this is where his real skill is weaving these puzzles and disparate bits of information and making them all seem like a seamless whole. His use of symbolism, the blade and the chalice symbolism, and the connections he makes with that, they're wonderful, but they're fanciful. I came across a wonderful thing on the internet the other day, actually, about Robert Langdon going into a lift. You remember the blade and chalice symbols? That's the blade and that's the chalice. He goes into a lift, and there are the blade and chalice symbols on the wall of this lift. And he's in this metal box, which clearly is symbolic of a woman's womb, and it's in an elevator shaft, and he presses the blade symbol, and the whole thing goes up, and then he presses the chalice symbol, and the whole thing goes down. Amazing!
So now we know that Mary Magdalene is buried under the lift shaft.
Exactly. She's under the lift shaft of the Louvre and not under the pyramid. That's it.
I think we need to be drawing things to a close in a moment. There was one more question in the middle, please.
I think this is too slightly off topic, but actually, based on what you spent a lot of time talking about the manuscripts that we've had for the Gospels, and thought really came to me, in fact, you've got the Gospels, and they were written to be sent out all over the place, so it's quite reasonable that there'll be thousands, millions of copies in the ancient times, should be written and read by various different people. The Acts of the Apostles, a historical document, essentially, again, good reason there being lots of copies spread around. Revelations, apocryphal, again, probably a lot of people want to read that sort of thing, so there'll be lots of copies. The letters that Paul wrote, I've been reading one of them, as you know better than I would, but say Corinth, probably wouldn't have had more than about 300,000 people there, might have been a lot more, but certainly would be under a million. So think about less than 10% of the population probably would be Christian at the time Paul was writing. That's not actually that many people, so why a letter which is basically advice to a church, if it's going to be copied a few times, because obviously there will be quite a few separate churches there, but to generate so many copies that there would actually be sufficient copies surviving for people to be able to, probably 1,000 years later, be able to collate this properly into part of what we've got today. And this isn't just one letter, but there's, most of the New Testament is made up of letters. At the end of the day, a letter in itself doesn't generate the need to be able to make multiple copies of it in the same way that you would imagine the Gospel would. I'm just curious as to what we thought, if there's an answer to that question, as to why there are so many copies in us that we've actually got them surviving out. I know that this is a lot of overworking, but the second letter of four eggs are three meters plus. But I was just wondering if you had any thoughts as to why that.
Interesting.
Well, I think the thing that it shows, and the fact that there are so many manuscripts, that's just a historic fact, it's not arguable. And the fact that there are so many manuscripts shows that this movement that grew so explosively during the last years of the Roman Empire attached huge importance to these documents. And then you kind of say, well, why did they rank those documents so highly? And not other documents like the Gospel of Thomas or the Gospel of Jesus or any of these other things. And it seems to me that what's going on is that they rapidly accepted documents because they saw that the documents came from people whose words were important. So you've got one letter in the New Testament which is really doesn't say anything very significant at all. It's about a runaway slave and asking his master to accept him back. But the church preserved it, and it becomes part of our New Testament. Now, why did they preserve it? The only reason that makes any sense is because of who it was in Britain. Just as today, we would probably preserve the letters of Shakespeare.
Even if the letters of Dan Brown.
Well, even if they're on trivial subjects, it's because of the importance of the attention to the author.